Imagine you're in a hospital and you're in dire need of an organ. Your doctor comes up to you in their scrubs and they say, we have an organ for you, but there's only one small problem. The donor is at a slight risk of having a bloodborne disease like HIV. They tested negative, but because they're in this high-risk group, we don't usually recommend these people as organ donors. But if you consent to it, you can have the organ. What would you say?
I think if I knew that I was going to die without this organ, I would definitely take the opportunity and say yes. I mean, people are on the list for years sometimes, so...
I think I'd probably ask the doctor, yeah, what risk are we talking here? Is it 1%, 0.1%, 10%? But unfortunately, the doctor previously wouldn't have had access to that statistic because no one had really done that research. But interestingly, there's a researcher at the University of Sydney who's just published a paper in the MJA today about this particular topic. So Dr. Karen Waller is a medical doctor and PhD candidate at the University of Sydney School of Public Health.
And we're just about to catch up with her to hear about what she's found.
Hello.
Oh, hi, Karen.
How are you doing?
Hey, good, Felicity.
Hey, nice to meet you again.
Meet you again.
Yes.
Hey, nice to meet you.
This is the Medical Republic. I'm Francine Crimmins.
And I'm Felicity Nelson. Later in this episode, we're speaking to TMR reporter Penny Durham. Penny's just got back from Madrid, where she attended one of the biggest summits for respiratory medicine in the world. And she's got some really interesting insights to share on vaping.
Yeah, so that's up a bit later. But first, let's get into our first topic of today, which is looking at high-risk people, or at least what we now consider high-risk people for organ donation, and how scales actually might be tipping. And these people may be the future of boosting up the Australian organ donation registry.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Waller.
Thanks very much for having me along.
So do you want to just give us a summary of your paper?
Sure. So the study that we've done looks at some organ donors who've previously been rejected for organ donation because of concerns that they might pass on an infection to a recipient. In my study, we try to calculate what sort of risks the donors who have increased risk behaviours that put them at risk for bloodborne viruses like hepatitis B and C and HIV, what kind of risk they actually have if they test negative for all those infections, and put that in an Australian context, which we've never had data in Australia for this before.
Yeah, so what's the reason that these people who are HIV negative or negative for any other bloodborne disease, what's the reason that they currently can't donate organs? Is it because they're at high risk of getting these diseases and therefore you're not sure, no matter when you test them, you can't be sure that they haven't just contracted it? Is that the idea?
So that's the concern, that there's a standardised list of risk behaviours that's accepted by transplantation societies around the world, and these are people who are more likely to pick up bloodborne viruses than people who don't have those behaviours. There's a delay between when you get exposed to a virus and when that virus becomes detectable with our tests, which means that there's a window period where we can't pick up the virus. And that means that for every organ donor, there is a tiny risk of a window period infection. So by doing that questionnaire, we try and tease out people who we think are at higher risk of having recently acquired an infection. So the groups who are defined by the guidelines as being at increased risk for organ transplantation purposes include people who inject drugs, men who have sex with men, people who've been recently incarcerated, sex workers, and people who have a sexual partner who belongs to one of those categories. Essentially, what we found is that the absolute risk of those viruses are low, even if you have risk behaviours, as long as you test negative for those infections. And this is particularly true, particularly timely when we've got new hepatitis C curative therapies, which has been something that's held us back before. So this means we might be able to increase the number of organ donors by accepting organs that we previously thought were too risky.
And what would that increase in number look like?
We don't have any, there's no hard data for Australia about this. We've had a bit of a look at a cohort of referrals to New South Wales. It's over the period 2010 to 2015. But we found that there was about 5 organ donors per year who were rejected because of their increased risk behaviours and no other reason, that could potentially be used if they test negative. That sounds like a small number, but each of those organ donors can go on to donate to up to 6 recipients. And over that time period, those five donors would have been about an extra 5% of the donor pool. So that's just New South Wales data. So we'd be projecting to speculate on what it could be like in, over all of Australia.
So it occurs to me that one of the potential benefits of including this group of people as potential organ donors is that they might happen to be younger or healthier in other respects compared to other potential organ donors. And what I mean by that is a lot of people live, you know, into their 80s or the 70s, and by that point when they pass away they might have a lot of, you know, other chronic illnesses, and getting an organ from one of those donors, you know, if you weigh it up, it might actually be better to take on the risk that you could get an infectious disease rather than, you know, taking an organ from someone who has all of these other chronic health issues. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so I think some unpublished work we've done in Australia, but also published work from overseas, does suggest that donors who have risk behaviours for bloodborne viruses tend to be younger and healthier than the rest of the organ donor pool. I think how that weighs out in terms of impact on recipients is difficult to tease out. I think it's probably more important to focus on the fact that the absolute risks we're talking about from people who test negative, who belong to those groups, are really, really low. So this is a big problem in America. They have the opioid epidemic in America is pretty profound, and in their populations of organ donors, people who have increased risk behaviours are now 25% of the organ donor pool, which is a lot higher than it would be in Australia. And they've done studies using their waiting list system, where they compared people who accepted donors who have this increased viral risk but test negative, as well as other recipients who chose to wait for a donor organ that didn't have the same risk. I think this was in kidneys specifically, hence they're able to wait on dialysis. And they found there was actually a survival benefit for those people who took the kidneys that were at an increased risk of transmitting a bloodborne virus but tested negative. It may be different in Australia. We have a different waiting list system and different healthcare systems, but I think it may just be that the shorter waiting time itself in America was the reason that people who took these organs actually benefited in a really measurable way.
And another thing that we've seen more recently is that a lot of these bloodborne diseases are so manageable now. Is there any research on that post-donation, and how many people actually end up getting infected? And
so there's been studies looking at hepatitis C, and in international settings people have been doing hepatitis C positive to negative transplants now with really good outcomes. It's still usually in a trial sort of setting, but the hepatitis C can then be deliberately cured after transplantation. This can be done in Australia, usually amongst liver transplant recipients who are very unwell. That already happens underway. We know hepatitis B can be effectively suppressed after transplantation. It's just another pill to the regime a day. For all of these infections, the main thing is that we know about them early and get people onto the right therapy. If someone has an unexpected transmission, that's when bad events can occur, which wouldn't be expected in the settings of where we've are aware of people's risk behaviours and have tested them prior to transplantation.
So when an organ donation recipient gets the organ and they happen to get, say, HIV or hepatitis C, I understand that during that transplantation period they're on a lot of immunosuppressant drugs. Does that impact the patient if they happen to also get that infectious disease at that critical time?
So, I mean, first of all, to caveat, transmission of infectious diseases through organ transplantation happens incredibly rarely because clinicians are very risk averse. You know, this is the kind of stuff that when it happens, it gets written up into a medical journal because we don't want it to happen. Apart from, of course, and even when we do deliver it hepatitis C positive to negative, that's been a bit of a stir with curing. In the deliberate setting of giving hepatitis C infected patients organs to people who don't have hepatitis C, outcomes have been good. With the deliberate cure of hepatitis C post. If there has been an unexpected transmission, outcomes can be quite poor, which is why we try to avoid unexpected transmissions of infections. Or if we were to use donors who have increased risk, part of that, where that's been implemented internationally, has involved routine testing of recipients post-transplant to make sure that if there is any transmission, that is picked up on.
And what about patients who are HIV positive and are giving organs to other HIV positive patients, or the same with other infections? Is that something that happens in Australia?
I'm not aware of it happening in Australia. I'm not aware that it's whether it's specifically precluded or not. And I think part of the shift that we're advocating for in my research is to consider risk on a case-by-case basis. But there were previously enough numbers to run a hepatitis C positive waiting list for kidney transplant recipients to accept a kidney from a donor who was hepatitis C positive, but even that never had very large number of patients on it, and hepatitis C is a lot more prevalent than HIV.
Sure.
So the scale of that issue is not huge.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing a little bit of your research.
No worries. I hope that was informative.
Next up, we're bringing Penny on the show to talk about some of the latest on vaping from one of the biggest respiratory conferences in the world. Before that, though, we're going to take a little break with some sponsored content. For this segment, the Medical Republic interviewed Dr. Mariam Siddiqui, the CEO of MetaOptima, on the topic of how drones could change dermatology.
Thanks, Dr. Siddiqui. Welcome back to the Medical Republic. We've heard that you've been developing some tech where a drone with a smartphone may actually be able to do a full body scan for moles. It sounds very, very futuristic. Could you maybe explain it to us?
Yes, the drone project is my favorite project in our R&D department. It's actually, imagine a dermatology office, fully intelligent, automated. So what do you see? Documentation, imaging, diagnosis, and providing care to our patients. It was started from a meeting I had in one of the major cancer centers in New York. The doctor there was asking me, Mariam, I spent 45 minutes for imaging and just documentation for my high-risk patients. Do you guys have anything that could help with this? I was working on robotics at the time, and also the AI system that we have, the platform that we have, DermEngine. We were looking at different imaging tools and how we can automate this. Robots were expensive, so $200,000. I was like, yes, it can be automated, but that's going to be expensive. I need something that can be very affordable and packed small, because we have a small office in our clinics, and also scalable, so we can offer to many thousand doctors and patients, not just few centers here and there. So the idea was really born looking at the imaging workflow in the clinic, and the only thing we could find was a drone that could be intelligent, just because we can put the DermEngine brain inside the drone in a chip that actually is running the drone, and it can take photos, it can zoom in, it can get closer. It can document the whole exam in 3 minutes, right? And it's automated. So you don't need to hire a full-time photographer or melanographer, we call in melanoma centers, to take photos. And the beauty of the system is that we eliminate or minimize the human error in documentation. Because if I come to your clinic this, today, you take my photos, next time I come, you probably have different lighting, you have probably different room, you have different even nurse or someone who's going to take my photos. They won't be the same, lighting won't be the same, distance won't be the same, orientation won't be the same, so which means the data won't be really repeatable to compare and be accurate. Doctors or patients are not flying the drone, by the way. It's sitting on their desk, but actually they can just click on their DermEngine account, scan the patient, and the patient has a stand. The drone is scanning the patient, going around the patient, documenting the full body images, building the patient's 3D body map, mapping everything to this 3D body map, and the next time the patient comes, the drone has that exam and is gonna repeat the exact same imaging process. So one of the doctors was asking me, what if it hits the wall, it hits the window? I was like, no, the drone that can find cancer for you will be intelligent not to hit the wall and, not to hit the patient. But actually, we have supervisory systems, which is, of course, needed for patient safety, for indoor regulations.
So we're also welcoming our political journalist, Penny Durham, back. She's been overseas in Spain. Not all sunning herself though and drinking sangria. She's been very busy at one of the biggest respiratory conferences. Is that right?
That's right. Yes. No, there was no sangria for me particularly. It was a huge conference, 22,000 delegates, 550 sessions, 4,000 bits of new work presented. It was massive.
So I imagine they had quite a bit of discussion about vaping, which has become this massive debate.
Yeah, it is. It's a very hot topic at the moment. There were a few sessions on that. Obviously, it's of huge interest at the moment because of this terrible outbreak of lung disease in the US, which I just read is up over 1,100 cases and 23 deaths, including one teenager, as we're recording.
I didn't know it was that bad, really. Mm. And I think it's related to vaping.
Well, everybody who counts as a case has vaped.
Really?
Yes.
And do we know anything about how frequently they vape or anything like that?
Everyone's really different. It's sort of a lot of heterogeneity in it, and it's which is why the detective work by the epidemiologists at the moment is so difficult, because everybody has smoked different kinds of products. Most of them have smoked THC products. So the CDC is warning everybody to stop vaping, especially the THC, until they work out what is responsible for it. The actual disease itself, they thought for a while that it was lipoid pneumonia, which is what you get when you aspirate fats. But recently a group of Mayo Clinic doctors did some histopathology on lung biopsies from some of these patients and found that it's presenting more like a chemical burn, which is nasty. So there's a lot of panic, a lot of various state and federal attempts to ban flavoured e-cigarettes, and legal challenges to those bans are being mounted. And of course, the people who think that vaping is actually a really good way to help people stop smoking have pointed out the absurdity of banning vaping flavours while you're leaving cigarettes on the shelf, when they are killing almost 500,000 people in the US alone every year. And it is also important to recognise that this is something new. Like, vaping has been widespread for about a decade, and there have only been like a few sporadic cases of pneumonia linked to vaping in all that time. So there must be some new contaminant, but they can't work out yet what it is.
Was it a similar kind of product that they were taking?
Not really. Like, because it's basically a black market product, it's not properly regulated in the US. You can buy it from wherever. You can buy it from a street corner. You can buy it online. You can mix your own solutions. So you get these like bathtub concoctions, which are just like bathtub gin in how reliable they are and how potent they are. And obviously you don't know what kind of contaminants might be in there. This sort of seems to be really a regulation problem in the US, because you just don't know what you're getting.
And when you were at the Congress in Madrid, what was the word on the vaping situation?
Well, the official word literally was one word: don't. The former president of the ERS, Jorgen Vespo, you get a lot of really super complicated, busy slides at these things. He put up a slide with one massive word on the slide: don't. And he said that was the entire ERS position statement in a nutshell. He thinks, or the entire ERS seems to think, that the harm reduction case is built on flawed arguments, that e-cigarettes are in themselves harmful, so how can they be reducing harm? And the room, which was packed, everybody was there, the room was generally very supportive of this, and the society has also passed a new bylaw which treats funding from e-cigarette makers as equivalent to funding from big tobacco, and that automatically excludes you from membership of the ERS. So they're pretty hard line and on vaping, and only one person in that whole room got up to express a more qualified view of vaping, Dr. Nick Hopkinson from the UK outfit Action on Smoking and Health, or ASH. England is pretty different from Europe on this point, because Public Health England thinks that there is actually a role for e-cigarettes in smoking cessation, and says that they're about 95% safer than cigarettes. There is a bit of controversy around that number, but they think it could be, even more, 97%, 98%, but that's sort of the number that you hear. And Dr. Hopkinson pointed out that it was a little bit rich for Europe to be lecturing England, which has a much lower smoking rate, and it tightly regulates e-cigarettes so that it hasn't seen the same kind of health disaster as you have in the US, and nor has it seen the same take-up of vaping among adolescents. And I thought he was pretty courageous to get up and put his head in the lion's mouth. And so I grabbed him out of the session for a little interview, and here's a little bit of our conversation.
Yeah, I think that one of the problems with e-cigarettes is that because they're new and interesting, and people have concerns about them, and they worry about the links to the tobacco industry, that you end up with a very almost aggressive form of argument, and people take positions, and they are interested in the things that support their position, and they dismiss the other side. The main problem is that smoking is on course to kill a billion people in the 21st century. We need to stop that, and we know what works. So you have to put up prices, you have to ban advertising, you have to keep the tobacco industry out of policy, you have to give people help to quit, warn people about the risks. It's possible to get rates down. So in the UK, our adult smoking rate's down to about 15%. I think in Australia it's 12% now. So that 12% or that 15% hides a substantial group of adults who have been smoking for a long time and who are at very high risk of smoking-related diseases now. In an ideal world, or even in a sensible world, those people would have the benefit of the kind of the societal interventions I talked about already, which help people to quit. So for people who smoke, switching to an e-cigarette is going to be safer as long as they switch completely, because it doesn't contain many of the toxic chemicals that are in tobacco smoke, and the ones that are there are just much lower levels. So no one's really maintained that they're harmless, but they are much less risky.
So Dr. Hopkinson basically told the society, you really need to make some strong statements about smoking too, because you can smoke in all your cafes and you have higher rates than England. And I think England does have something to say to Europe on the question of vaping. He got sort of closed down pretty swiftly by the panel, and they didn't let him have any more bites of the cherry.
So what's the situation in Australia then?
Yeah, it's controversial here whether e-cigarettes should be considered a therapeutic good, because they're having a therapeutic claim made for them, which is that they can help you get off tobacco, or whether instead it would be better to regulate it as a consumer good. That way it could just easily sit alongside the cigarettes and compete with them better. And there are passionate advocates on both sides. It's been through a parliamentary inquiry, and the committee came down in favour of the status quo, although there were dissenting views on the committee. The Liberal MP, Andrew Lamming, said his entire dissenting report said, "Life is short and shorter for smokers. Just legalise vaping." So it's pretty succinct, although not quite as succinct as the old "don't" from the ERS. It's now going through an independent academic inquiry. One thing I'm pretty sure isn't helping is that big tobacco companies, which are obviously also getting into the e-cigarette market, they're actively lobbying members of our government to make e-cigarettes a consumer good so that we can bring down our smoking rate even further. And the industry is so incredibly two-faced on this. In the West, they're claiming they want people to stop smoking and vape instead, whereas in Africa and in Asia, they're on a huge, massive push to get everybody smoking. So I suspect that their advocacy might actually be the kiss of death for that side of the debate, if only because no one's going to want to do them any favours at all.
I guess that's like when you look at Philip Morris, how their 10-year plan is supposedly a smoke-free future. Which, I don't know how they're planning to make any money if not.
Well, no, it's nonsense. And it would be corporate suicide for any of these companies to pull out of tobacco manufacturing, so none of them is going to go first. They're shoring up their markets in the West by promoting vaping, but they're definitely, like all over Asia and Africa, they're building new tobacco manufacturing, cigarette making factories, and the walls and the streets are just plastered with cigarette advertising. So you really can't believe a word that they say.
And Penny, you're at a respiratory conference, and like any medical conference, you like to think that people maybe practice what they preach, but you had a pretty interesting story from Madrid.
Yeah, it was pretty funny. I was walking along, this massive conference venue, looking at all the non-smoking signs and thinking, this is a respiratory conference. How necessary is that really? And just as I was having that thought, I walked through a cloud of smoke and I thought that's strange, and I backtracked a few steps and saw a man hiding behind a bush. Having a bag, having a diary. So, Even the experts sometimes find it difficult to practice what they preach.
Okay, that's it for this week's podcast. Thanks so much for joining us again. So you can subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, iTunes, or whatever podcatcher you prefer. We'll see you next time.